Joey Block. Well, it's officially summer, and boy, does it feel it like that outside right now. The sun is hot, and it feels humid and all that type of stuff, especially with the rain that's expected this coming weekend. It definitely feels like summer out there, and it is hot. But in addition to, you know, the weather heating up, things are also getting heated in the political and legal world as well. Definitely a lot of developments on that front here. We'll get you all caught up now from all the big headlines this week. We're going to start with here in the New York City area. You know, obviously, Jersey's right next door to New York, and boy, do we have a lot of things to talk about in that state. New York's top court has declined to hear an appeal of the gag order on former President Trump in his hush money trial. The Court of Appeals ruled that the order does not raise substantial constitutional issues warranting an immediate intervention. Now, however, this could be short-lived because Judge Juan Merchan is expected to rule soon on a defense request to lift the gag order. So we'll have to see whether the judge actually goes towards the defense's wishes on that, or if he sticks with the prosecution and keeps this gag order in place. The order prevents Trump from commenting on witnesses, jurors, and others who were involved in the trial. Trump's lawyers argue that he should be allowed to fully address the case given the continued public criticism of him by some witnesses in the case, including his ex-attorney Michael Cohen, as well as Stormy Daniels, that adult film star who claims that her and the former president got busy together and had themselves an affair. So that is what's at stake there. And the Manhattan DA's office urged the court to reject the appeal. That is why things are happening the way they are. The prosecution has been heavily pushing for this gag order to stay in place as long as possible. Now, that order is currently in effect as we speak here, despite the verdict coming down weeks ago. So as of this recording, that gag order is still currently in place. So this is a strategy that is interesting here. Why does everyone care about this gag order so much, especially since the trial's over? Well, there's still pending litigation out there. The Trump team is obviously trying to appeal, and in an appeal, these things are going to come up. So the thought process could be, on the prosecution side, is, well, you know, there's still litigation happening here. We can't have this gag order lifted until it's all done and that the appeal has been done and has either been denied or has been accepted and whatever, and we need to have that there. There's that side of it. Then there's the other side of, well, the trial's over. Why do we need to bother with this at all? And why would the Trump team want this to be lifted so badly? Well, as you know, the politics of this has been quite interesting for the former president, because every time he's had one of these legal hiccups or forks in the road, his fundraising has gone up and the polling numbers have gone up in the Republican primary. Now, the general election's a little different. The polling, really, it's very confusing depending on which poll you look at. Some say he went up a little bit, some say he went down, but more or less, it really had a minor shift in the way voters viewed Trump, despite there being previous polling data showing that a conviction would be more damaging for the former president. But as of right now, it does not appear that is going to be the case. And there was polling in the final lead up to this that said like a small number, it'd be like somewhere in the 7th percentile would actually be moved by this. And based on the polling we're seeing, that seems to be the case. But Trump does like to talk about it because that does energize his voters. It does energize. It's the bread and butter of his traditional supporters, and they like to hear him talk about that. He's also a guy who likes to defend himself, and he hasn't really been able to do that. So he wants to be the guy who finally gets the last word, which is quite ironic because we recently learned that he's going to get the last word in the upcoming presidential debate that is happening next week as well. So here, he wants his word. He wants his piece of the pie. So politically, they think it could work out for him because, you know, it's done well so far. Why not have him talk about it more? Talk about it. The two-tier justice system. They think that is a winning message for them, especially among certain communities. So if he has the gag order lifted, then he can talk about it. But then there's the other school of thought, and this is what a lot of Republicans out there may be alleging, and there could be something, because again, these are elected officials a lot of the time in New York, the court system and the DA's office. There are Democrats. Could be, you know what, if this is, as they say, is the Trump team likes to say, a sham prosecution, then maybe they're trying to silence him. They don't want him to talk about this. They want to keep him quiet as much as possible. And if he violates that gag order, they can fine him or even, you know, as Judge Marchon warned during the trial, possible jail time, which would, you know, inhibit him to go out and campaign. So there could be a political strategy on that end, too, if you buy into that theory that this is all an effort to get Trump and to hurt him and his presidential chances and to be pro-Biden. If you believe all that, there is that school of thought that could play into it as well. And we'll see how long this gag order plays out, especially you go into the appeals process. Does Judge Marchon just say, you know what, the trial's done, let's get rid of the gag order and we'll hash out everything in the appeal? And then does Trump speak after that? We'll watch. We'll wait and see how this all plays out. But it's going to be fascinating to see as we're going into this. We're going into the debate. That's coming up next week. And both these candidates are going to be asked some tough questions here, including President Biden, whose family is dealing with their own legal troubles here, and particularly related to his son, Hunter. Well, there's a new update on that. Hunter has withdrawn a motion for a new trial after filing shortly before that he wanted to have a retrial, wanted the whole thing to be retried. So where does this all go here? What's this? Why would someone submit a filing saying they want it retried and then quickly withdraw it like hours later? Well, let's dig a little more into this and get into the detail here. Well, this is all in regards to that federal gun trial where a jury found him guilty on all charges, all three charges, all those felony counts just a week ago. So this is all in the time span of a week that this is happening. His defense attorneys didn't provide any explanation for why this was done at all. And the now removed court filings argued that there was a technical hiccup with the courts related to Hunter Biden's pre-trials appeals that should have been prevented this trial from happening, that the trial judge shouldn't have been able to proceed with a jury trial in Delaware. That's the claim. In the court filing, the defense team says, quote, the court impaneled a jury and proceeded to trial before the Court of Appeals returned jurisdiction to the court by issuing its mandate. Consequently, the conviction must be vacated here. Close quote. Now, that mandate there that they're referring to is when an appellate court hands down a decision that now it makes clear to the lower court that that decision, by issuing the mandate, it notifies the lower court of that decision. You know, it often takes a couple days or a couple hours later. It's a very quick procedure. It's just a notification. That is the mandate of it. And this mechanism typically has the lower courts gives back the jurisdiction for the case to proceed with it as appropriate. So it's basically a legal proceeding where you kind of just throw it in the hands, make sure this court is in charge of it now, and they have to, it's a handoff, essentially. So the Hunter Biden team claimed that it didn't do that. That is what is at play here. Now, Hunter nor his attorneys have spoken out publicly about the filing being withdrawn, and he is currently facing up to 25 years in prison for these charges. The president's son is set to be tried on a separate trial, separate charge of federal tax fraud in September. So he's a busy guy, clearly. And that could be why, because if you're confused sitting there at home or on the treadmill or walking out or in the car, wherever you're listening to this, it's probably because it is a little confusing. And that could be why they pulled it. They're trying to make this argument that the handoff didn't happen. And that could possibly be why the lawyer said, you know what, if we don't understand what's going on, how is anyone else going to understand this? So they were trying to make this technical argument of, oh, well, we didn't do it right, so the whole thing's got to be dismissed. And maybe just because it didn't make sense, they decided to pull it. Again, we don't have the explanation of why, but that could be a theory that it just didn't really hold water, and they were afraid it wouldn't hold the water, so they pulled it. Also, again, this is the realm of conspiracy, because Republicans have repeatedly been saying, oh, you know what, president says he's not going to pardon his son, he's not commuting the sentence, he's going to respect the verdict. But the reality could be, maybe they got the word from daddy, okay, Hunter is getting a sentence commuted, a pardon, we're not going to do anything here. We're just going to pull the filing, and we're just going to let it sit there. We're going to wait till the election, and we're going to see what happens. Because the theory is, by the people on the right, is, okay, Biden's going to run his election, whether he wins or loses, because if he wins, he'll be in the second term. He wants to run for re-election again. And if he loses, he's going to be out anyway, so it doesn't really matter. After the election, he will do whatever he's going to do with this, whether he's going to commute the sentence or just pardon them all together. That's the thought process here behind the theories of what is going to go on with Hunter. So if that's true, then maybe they did. But we're going to see whether there's more appeals. Maybe they want to go for a bigger appeal. Maybe they want to just go to a higher court and try it that way. We have to see what the Hunter Biden legal team's thought process is and what they're doing. Maybe they want to wait until after the tax trial has taken place. Maybe they want to try and do an all-in-one deal. That would be a little more difficult because that one is taking place in Los Angeles. This one happened in Delaware. Yes, they're both in federal court, but they have been separated now. It's not like where it was this time last summer where it was all packaged up in a nice little plea deal that Hunter and his team could have taken, and it would have all been set to go. Of course, the judge didn't really like it. And then when the Justice Department and the defense team tried to come back together, they couldn't agree. And then this thing went to trial, and Hunter got convicted on all three federal gun felony charges. And we'll have to see how he fares in the tax charges. Because remember, the gun charges were rarely prosecuted. These are not charges that are typically brought to this level. So if he's got problems there, the tax charges are a more common thing to prosecute. They could be a little worried there on the legal defense team, and maybe they want to put more focus there. That could be the thought process. Again, we want to make clear, we do not have as of this recording, we do not know why they decided to pull the filing, but the reality is they did. And that's going to be sitting in people's minds for a while. We'll see what they come out with. Or as always, we will update you on the latest here as we go along. But of course, we have to bring it back to the state level because a lot has been happening there, as you might have heard. And it has to do with what's going on next year. That's right. We have a governor's race next year, everybody. And the candidates are already jumping in like wildfire into this race. Conservative radio talk show host Bill Spadia has officially entered the race for governor. Spadia says he's running to restore common sense to New Jersey and promises to take on taxes, spending, borrowing, inflation, education, and illegal immigration. In his launch video, he says, quote, I am unapologetically conservative, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, and pro-Trump, close quote. Spadia also took a shot at Cittarelli because he couldn't resist the opportunity there because, as of you know, Cittarelli, I mean, he narrowly lost the governor's race by a few points. It was a tight election, a lot tighter than people thought it was going to be. A lot of people thought it was going to be a blowout and that Cittarelli was really going to have his ass handed to him. And the reality is that's not what happened. That's why Monmouth University, the gold standards of polls, they got a lot of blowback for that too. And that resulted in people having to go back and look at their methodologies. Well, anyway, so he took a shot at Cittarelli, and this is what happened in the video. He said, quote, Republicans are never going to take back our state if we nominate a 35-year career politician who's already lost twice for governor, close quote. So Spadia really driving them as a home that Cittarelli is the two-time loser. Why do we need to go for number three? That's the argument you're going to hear from a lot of these candidates. Because remember, Ed Durr, who is a state senator who beat out former state Senate President Steve Sweeney in a district that was leaning more Republican, then he got ousted last year in a Democratic wave. So that is an argument he made too, because he was a Cittarelli supporter and said, well, you know, we kind of got to move on here. We need a winner. That's the argument you're hearing. That's why you're seeing a lot more candidates who are lining up on the GOP side to take on Jack Cittarelli in a way you did not see last time. Well, the Cittarelli campaign fired back with a new radio ad blasting Spadia for past comments he's made about Trump, the Republican Party, and prominent GOP politicians in New Jersey. In the ad, the argument is made, quote, the problem is New Jersey Republicans won't win if we're divided. We need a serious leader who will win our party and fix the state. And it ain't Bill Spadia, close quote. Now, internal polling shows, you know, this is, I'll give you the asterisk here. It is by a pro Cittarelli super PAC. This shows Cittarelli with an early lead of 33 points in this race. So according to the poll, Cittarelli has 44% support to Spadia's 11%, while State Senator John Bramnick gets 3%, and former State Senator Ed Durr rounds out the field with 2%. 38% of Republicans are currently undecided. On the Democratic side, NJEA president and former Montclair mayor Sean Spiller jumped into the gubernatorial race. Spiller says it's time for a middle-class governor who can guarantee hard-working families can afford to live and work in New Jersey. Now, to no one's surprise, that union has backed him all the way for governor. Again, we'll be watching this race for sure, and we will be bringing you the updates as if more candidates jump in or if some drop out, because there are four candidates on the GOP side that at the moment that field seems to be set. On the Democratic side, we could possibly see an entry from two members of Congress, Josh Gottheimer and Mikey Sherrill, after the November election. Now, here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. The primary results are in, and general election matchups across the state are now set. This includes those in New Jersey's 3rd congressional district, where the incumbent, Andy Kim, has given up his seat to run for Senate. There, physician Rajesh Mohan beat out his nearest opponent, big fundraiser and immigration consultant Shirley Maya Kuzik, by over 7 points. Dr. Mohan received 38% to Mayakuzik's nearly 31%. Mohan had all the county organizational lines in the district, while Mayakuzik largely relied on self-funding and Burlington County throwing out the county organizational line and using office balloting instead. Now, he goes into the general election to go up against Assemblyman Herb Conaway, who has been in the state legislature for close to 25 years now, in a district that has shifted more Democratic in recent years, largely due to redistricting efforts here in New Jersey. Mohan hopes that he can reverse that trend by talking to voters who typically don't lean towards the GOP. Well, joining me now is New Jersey 3rd District Republican Congressional candidate, Dr. Rajesh Mohan. Dr. Mohan, thanks for coming on.
Sure, thank you.
You're coming off a big win in the primary. You beat your nearest opponent by close to 8 points. How'd you pull it off?
A lot of hard work. I got into the race just about 4 months ago or so. But most importantly, my campaign has been an inclusive campaign. You work for the people. You work for, you know, with no personal agendas. And the best thing that I've heard on the campaign trail, whether it's one-on-one meetings or meet and greets or town halls, is that everybody who has connected with me and talked with me has said, you do not talk like a politician. You talk like one of us. You talk like a common person, which was very refreshing and to hear, and actually very humbling, because, I've not done this before. And for me, it is about getting the people's job done. That is what I bring to the table. My campaign is an issue-based campaign with my track record of being a problem solver, successful interventional cardiologist with an MBA, a physician leader, successful in turning around the fortunes of a hospital by improving patient care, improving patient services, not by laying off people, not by cutting off jobs, but by increasing jobs, increasing productivity, and serving the communities better. So my job is the people's job, and I've connected with a lot of people, and I'm grateful and thankful for, you know, having been elected as a Republican nominee. We worked very hard for it, myself, my team, look forward to winning in November.
Now you're currently the Republican nominee for Congress in the 3rd District.
Yes.
Take us back to people who may have not been following the campaign step by step. What made you decide to initially jump into this thing?
A lot of things, but most importantly, I believe the foundations of that had been set by my parents, who helped me develop a strong sense of empathy, which encouraged me to work hard, take nothing for granted, leave nothing to chance. And all these teachings in my upbringing, they inspired me to, you know, successfully take on challenges, think out of the box, just do the best I can do to the best of my God-given abilities for the maximum good that I can do every day. And that's probably why I organically went into medicine and just tried to make lives better one person at a time. And over the past few years, after COVID, I was running the hospital in the C-suite as a chief medical officer, as well as seeing patients on the front lines with my colleagues and nurses. And I saw the big disconnect between the public officials, the public health officials, and the boots on the ground, so to speak. And I got that firsthand experience because I was in the policymaking room, in the boardrooms, as well as seeing patients. And I saw the big disconnect between people flying too high over 30,000 feet and the people at the ground level. So I got a unique experience and knowledge of how to connect that, which a lot of people, unfortunately, do not do, despite their best intentions. So I thought it is about time that, based on whatever conversations I've had with the Republican leadership, that and people in general, they encouraged me to run, and they thought that, you know, I would do a fine job trying to scale up the same capabilities, the same thought process, the same thinking out of the box, to a level where it could be scaled up and benefit more people rather than just one patient at a time. Not to minimize that by in any means, but just to do it at a larger scale and do more good for more people than I can possibly do right now. And my family's been a big support, and I talked to my wife and my mom, and they're like, you know, it's about time you did this, because I think you can give back more to the communities and more to the people, and it would be a good thing for everybody. It would be a win-win situation for the party, for the district, for the people, for everybody, for independents, for moderate Democrats. I've talked to a lot of them, and my platform is, in fact, appealing to all of them, you know, Republicans, independents, and moderate Democrats. So I'm in it to win it and do as much good as possible without any personal agendas to help the people in the district and even beyond.
You've mentioned that you've never done this before. You've never run for office. You've never held public elected positions that, you know, a lot of people who do this have leading into this. What experience would you bring to Congress?
So number one, I never held public office, but I've been in public service for more than 20 years and worked with the local communities. I've actually was involved in running the COVID operations in my hospital with local communities as in the C-suite level. So just the hospital, more than $500 million yearly revenue. It was slated for a 7-digit loss in the first year that I took over as a chief medical officer. Within a year, we turned it around to almost a 7-digit profit. Like I said, without any cutting costs or anything. I bring in real world experiences. Most of the people in Congress that I've seen, you know, they are mainly career politicians and paper pushers. And I do not have a reputation of pushing paper. I have a reputation of making a difference, of doing stuff and doing tangible things, which benefit people. I introduced artificial intelligence in my hospital in 2018. Artificial intelligence is a fad right now, you know, very fashionable to talk about it in 2024. But we were one of the first hospitals in the state of New Jersey to bring artificial intelligence for the benefit of people. So there are a lot of things that I bring from an administrative experience, from entrepreneurial experience. I've been running a private practice simultaneously while I ran the hospital as chair of medicine and chief medical officer for a total of almost 10 years while running a private practice simultaneously. So I know how to run a small business, a medium-sized business, a large-sized business. Administrative skills. I taught medical students, residents, fellows. It's an experience which any politician in the state, especially my opponent, Herb Conaway, it'll stack up very nicely against him. And I'm looking forward to debate him on any topic whatsoever because he does not have a good track record despite being in public office for 25 years with essentially nothing to show for the good of the people to the scale that I've been able to accomplish. In fact, he's been bad for New Jersey, raising taxes, you know, made more regulations, made it difficult for businesses, made it more difficult for healthcare by increasing regulations, made it more difficult to patients in general. So I bring a lot of stuff to the table, which I think there should be less career politicians in Congress and more people who have real world experiences. I think there are too many lawyers there in Congress, and a lot of people who have not had actually a real job in their past life. I think it's supposed to be for the people with experiences and knowledge and the right mindset. I'm a cardiologist with a critical care mindset. I don't believe in turfing off things for the next year or the 5 years from now. I believe in doing things now in real time. And that is what I will bring to Congress and make things happen, just like I've done all my life.
As you've mentioned, you're going up against Assemblyman Herb Conaway. He's been in politics particularly New Jersey politics, for a long time, has a lot of connections, has a lot of constituents who know who he is, has a lot of money behind him. How do you plan to go up against a guy like that who has this reputation, all this money behind him, and you yourself, you're a new guy who may not have access to the same things?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that although he's been in state legislator for about 25 years, I ran the primary. Nobody knows him in Monmouth County. Nobody knows him in Mercer County. There's just a few towns that he represents in Burlington County. The rest of the people don't even know who he is, don't even know much about what he has done, if anything. And the people who do know him, including Democrats and definitely independents and Republicans, they do not like what he has done over the past 25 years. He's even, although he won the primary because of, like you said, the big money that pushed him in the primary as opposed to his other opponents. Not that they were that great, but, he won that because of that. So I'm the official Republican nominee. I've worked hard to, achieve that. And I have the full backing of the Republican Party. I have the full backing of everybody who I know. So we're going to work hard. We're going to not let anything bog down. I have my track record. He has his track record. I can compare with it with his anytime anybody can, and we will win. We will win, substantially in November with all the hard work and the effort. Like what my parents taught me, never take anything for granted. Always work hard. So that is what we're going to do, and we are in it to win it in November.
It's important to note here that this seat has been held by Democrats for the past 5 years. Congressman Kim. Who is the current occupant of that seat, is currently pursuing the Senate seat that's up this year in New Jersey. Why is it time for a change? Why is it time for a Republican to be in that seat and not a Democrat?
That's a great question. And I've realized that all politics is local. I was just talking to a lot of people, in Mount Laurel, for that matter, just as an example, in Burlington. There were so many, they don't have people in Mount Laurel and the surrounding areas. They don't have proper access to 295. I mean, they take extra time to go to work, extra time to come back from work. All that time they could be spending time with their family or other activities that they wish to do. Those kind of things, they should have been done at the federal level. There's a lot of unhappiness in the people of the 3rd District, whether it is Burlington, Mercer, definitely Monmouth County, a lot of Burlington County, which is where most of the people votes are, and we are cognizant of that. But it's about doing work for the people. People are dissatisfied on multiple levels, including what is going on with illegal immigration, including what's going on with the economy, increased inflation, increased taxes, for all that Annie Kim in his 5 years has done, he hasn't brought enough money back to New Jersey from Washington, D.C., in spite of the fact that we are one of the top 10 states paying money to the federal government. We are at the bottom as far as getting money back. So I'm going to change that going to D.C., and people who've talked to me, they want it really bad because it doesn't make any sense that we are contributing so many dollars to the federal government and getting pretty much nothing back. And they do not want another paper pusher and a career politician to basically, just while away time, push paper and be non-productive and incompetent. Annie Kim seems to be a nice guy. I do not know him personally, but it's 5 years. And, he's an opportunist as far as I'm concerned. I'm not running against him. I'm running against a person who wants to be on his coattails. And Annie Kim actually took benefit of the Democratic Party line for about 5 years. And then when it did not suit him, he went against that. So, whatever their infighting is, the Democrats, you've seen what Bob Menendez is doing. You've heard about the news about Norcross, and Herb Conaway is very intricately connected with him and all the corrupt policies. So Democrats are awash in corrupt policy, especially in New Jersey, not to talk of the country. So it's about time that we have a fresh face, fresh thinking, critical thinking, a person who's not just going to push personal agendas, but work for the people. And that's where I come in.
You mentioned the indictment that came down this week on South Jersey Democratic power broker George Norcross. It's 13-count indictment, basically accusing him of using threats and a fear of economic and reputational harm to obtain lucrative property rights along the Camden waterfront. I just want to get your reaction there. I mean, your district touches in South Jersey, not necessarily this area. That would be his brother's district, Donald Norcross. That would be his district, but it still tips in the South Jersey. How does that impact South Jersey there? I mean, what's your overall take on it?
Yeah, first of all, an indictment of such a person who Herb Conaway calls a person of, and I'm paraphrasing, I do not know the exact quote, but something to the effect that, you know, he's been good for the party and good for him. I do not know how he has been good for Herb Conaway, and, you know, who knows what's going to come out in the indictments and connections between him and Herb Conaway. But Herb Conaway has been there for about 25 years. He's not much different in his own, you know, language and dealings with George Norcross. So who knows what's going to come out with that. But I think we need to put an end to this, this Bob Menendez, George Norcross, Herb Conaway, all this kind of stuff, come back to some clean politics, get some real people in there. And that is why I appeal not only to the Republicans, but to independents as well as moderate Democrats, sensible Democrats who want the right person. You know, whoever I've talked to, they want the same things. They want law and order. They want security. They want to stop illegal immigration. They want a better paycheck. They want lower gas prices. They want cheaper health care. They do not want. So whether you're Democrat, Republican, independent, it doesn't matter. You know, they just want the same things. And my appeal to all the people is look at the best candidate. Look at the candidate who's going to do the most for you, not for themselves. And that is why I believe the Republican Party believes that I'm the best candidate to win the district, go to work to D.C., and do a good job for the good of the people in the district. And the other thing which is kind of mind-boggling to me is that, you know, I've been very, very strong on anti-Semitism. And when all the stuff that was going on in college campuses, did not hear much from Herb Conaway, who's been there in the legislature for about 25 years. When you're a public official and there is stuff like anti-Semitism going on so rampantly, you have to speak up. You know, if I speak up right now, nobody knows me. I'm not a public health official. The people who I work with, they know who I am. But you need to speak up. You need to, raise your voice against anti-Semitism. It is abhorrent, as far as I'm concerned, that you're just going to keep quiet. And when something else happens where your personal agenda is involved or you're playing vote bank politics, that's the only time you're going to open your mouth. You have to be fair. You have to be fair, and you have to work for the people that you represent, no matter what background they come from. But you have to call right, and you have to call wrong. You cannot be timid about it. You cannot appease such kind of bad actions and then hope to represent the people in the right way. That is just unacceptable.
You brought up the rise in anti-Semitism on college campuses and in the country overall. We've seen this particularly at Rutgers University and Princeton University in the state of New Jersey. Rutgers in particular, they had encampments on their campuses. They negotiated with them to get them off, but in return, the university said that they would consider divesting from Israel or businesses that are tied with the Jewish state. And I had former state senator Ed Durr on the program a couple weeks back, who's running for governor now. He said if he's governor, Rutgers is getting their funding pulled. Do you think that action needs to be taken, that Rutgers needs to have their funding pulled for the actions that they have taken on this issue?
I think, you know, people need to have their feet held to the fire when they take actions which are anti-Semitic or against the Israel or against discrimination for that matter, any kind. I mean, it is common sense. And you know, I take it as a common sense. This is a war after the tragic, barbaric attack by Hamas on the Jewish people in Israel. Hamas wants a destruction and annihilation of Israel. That is what it wants. Israel cannot have a policy of appeasement with such barbaric people. In a war, there are victors and losers, and Israel has to win and end Hamas and its ideology so that such acts can never be repeated again. Unfortunately, and I feel for the civilians, and you know, my hearts go out to the people in Gaza, for the innocent civilians. These are unfortunate victims that pay the price for their bad, and in this case, evil leaders who just use them as pawns and human shields. It is tragic. It is really tragic for these thousands of innocent civilians to die. The conclusion of this war, it cannot be a ceasefire. You know, one is a victor, one is a loser. The loser surrenders. So Hamas leaders and Hamas, for the good of their own people, need to surrender. It is very, I mean, when we beat the Nazis, they surrendered. When we beat any other, you know, bad actor, they surrender. And the leaders are brought to justice. I do not know where the Rutgers people are coming from. I mean, they have this, you know, in a war, when you cannot just have a policy of appeasement. You just don't cease fire and let the other group regroup and then come and attack you again, especially when they want to annihilate you. I mean, it is not that difficult to understand. It is common sense. And it doesn't mean that, you know, all those innocent civilians who are dying in Gaza, it's of course tragic and bad, and it should not happen. But you cannot blame Israel and the Jewish people to defend themselves and to defend themselves from such barbaric acts and put an end to it, because this has been going on for too long. So I think, you know, to cut it to a one line thing, whoever is, you know, propounding this preposterous thing not to support Israel or not to support the Jewish people, or it is, you cannot, trade in anti-Semitism and have tropes like that. I mean, if you cut off, divest in Israel, who are you hurting? You're hurting the Jewish people. And if you really want to, do the right thing, put pressure on the Hamas people if you can, if you're that close with them, and surrender. If you surrender, then let, you know, justice happen like justice is supposed to happen, and let there be a rebuilding of Gaza, and the innocent civilians won't die over there. But until a war goes on, unfortunately, you know, the innocent civilians die in that. It has happened in every single war. So, you know, we have to be very clear in our thinking, in our approach, in solving these problems, because if we are muddled, then we just play games. That is all they do.
Now, Rutgers is a state-funded school. It's a state school, so it gets its funding directly from the state government. Should it have its funding pulled based on what action it has taken and what actions it could take if it, in fact, cuts ties with Israel?
So, the way I would look at it is that, you know, there are students that, you know, anytime you see all these protests, whether it is Rutgers, Columbia, anywhere, you have a small percentage, tiny percentage of people who are protesting. The majority of the students, they are not protesting. They don't agree to what's happening. And then there are people in leadership positions in Rutgers who are actually pandering to them, who are appeasing them. So instead of, you know, trying to solve the problem with a hammer, you need to kind of castigate or even fire those people who are playing softball or appeasement, and not let the majority, the vast majority of Rutgers, whether it is the faculty, whether it's the student population, suffer because of a few bad apples. Just like in Harvard or Columbia or UPenn, you need to take those bad apples out. They do not deserve to be in those positions. They need to be fired. So that is how I would approach that problem. I would not ruin Rutgers. Rutgers is a storied university and is the pride of New Jersey. And just because of a few bad apples, you don't want to destroy the whole legacy of Rutgers University. You need to take those bad apples out. And that is where, you know, you have to have clear thinking and put pressure on whoever it is to basically get those people out.
Okay, so you don't want to defund Rutgers, but it sounds like you want those people to be resigned or fired. Obviously, in the cases of UPenn and Harvard, those presidents ended up resigning or being forced to resign, etc. With Jonathan Holloway, the president of Rutgers, he's come under fire. You think he needs to go? Do you think he needs to resign, or the Board of Governors should give him the boot?
Anybody who's supporting the divesting from Israel should be fired.
Now, before we go here, I know we're running low on time here. I do want to get your take that has something similar to do with this, but also given your profession, you might have an interesting take on this. New York Governor Kathy Hochul is considering banning masks at protests and on public transit in the state after pro-Palestinian protesters have donned them in demonstrations across the country. This comes after a state ban on masks was repealed during the COVID pandemic due to public health concerns. Now, as someone who has worked in the healthcare industry, how do you feel about this proposal?
Yeah. So the government, from a healthcare perspective, I mean, what she's doing is probably from a security perspective and trying to mix healthcare. Healthcare, the government should not be getting into healthcare, number one, because healthcare should be, and being a physician myself, I strongly believe in the sanctity of the patient-doctor relationship. And it has to be, healthcare should be patient-centric for the benefit of the patients, not based upon what politicians or governments or lawyers or non-medical organizations, they should not be interfering in medical care provided by doctors. That is based on medical science and is evidence-based, whether it is between a man and his doctor or a woman and her doctor. So that is why, I believe that it should be left between the patient and the physician. And just, slightly moving away from that topic, because I know a lot of Democrats, they kind of paint all Republicans with a broad brush. And, based on what I just said about the sanctity of the patient-doctor relationship, I believe that, pregnant women should not be punished or imprisoned for making healthcare decisions about themselves, and neither should doctors be punished or imprisoned for providing healthcare to patients based upon evidence-based medicine, including, the variability of patients and their healthcare needs, including, medical termination of pregnancy. That should be based upon ensuring that the health of the woman is of utmost priority, because that is what healthcare is all about, upholding the beliefs and, the informed consent of the pregnant women, just like we do for any other surgeries, procedures, or healthcare needs of any patient. So healthcare should be based on medical science, scientific facts, and the patient's own beliefs and faith, which may vary among those that belong to even the same religion, for that matter, instead of, conforming to rigid beliefs or interpretations or opinions of others. So, that's where I stand on women's health and women's rights. For me, women's health is similar to anybody's health, whether it is a man or a woman. The government should not be in between that. There should be, obviously, respect for people of different faiths, and we should honor their faiths. But healthcare should be based on medical science. Just as an example, American College of OBGYN, they're, according to them, and including the UK's National Health Service, fetuses delivered before 22 weeks are not currently viable to survive, even if doctors try to save them. And most, in fact, about 1% of termination of pregnancies are only about 1%, and for some people it is too many, are done after 21 weeks, and fewer than 1% are done in the third trimester. So, just like I gave an example of whatever happened with Hamas and Israel, I mean, it would be really tragic if we force, the unfortunate Jewish women who've been raped by Hamas terrorists and their barbaric acts to be forced to have a Hamas terrorist child. I think, in my mind and many people's mind, that would not be the right thing. The same thing for, you know, for incest. I'm a cardiologist. I get consulted on high-risk pregnancies. We nurse patients on a regular basis. We advise them not to get pregnant before they get pregnant. Unfortunately or fortunately for them, they get pregnant. And then, you know, they are at a risk for their lives, and we take care of them. And so a lot of times, you know, women do not know that they are pregnant and they have ectopic pregnancies. They could die if they are not taken care of. So I think we have to really respect, you know, the patient-doctor relationship, give medical signs. I'm not in favor of, you know, abortions or late-term abortions. It rarely happens anyway. Like I gave you the numbers from the American College of OBGYN, less than 1%, and they are usually done only if the, you know, if they cannot save the life of the, if they have to save the life of the mother. And even in that process, they try to save the baby as well. There's a thing called perinatal palliative care, which actually helps not only in delivering the baby and probably even prolonging the life, even though they may have, you know, critical conditions. And that depends on, just like we have palliative care in adults. And if the next of kin decides to withdraw care, they withdraw care. The next of kin wants to continue care, then you continue care. But that is very rare in very, you know, conditions where the baby has essentially no chance of surviving. They're delivered. They're not aborted, but they're taken care of. I think we have to look at it from a medical science perspective and what is evidence-based. I practice evidence-based medicine on a regular basis. I have my own beliefs, and I'm sure other people have their own beliefs, and they're varying from one extreme to another. But it should be left to the woman, to the doctor, and the faith of the woman, and whatever they want to do, provided with some guidelines based on medical science. If you actually have early discovery of pregnancy and the baby is not going to survive, then, you know, there's not only physical trauma and the life of the mother that is at risk, but also mental trauma, something that they may actually go through when they're victims of rape and incest. So I think we have to look at it from a compassionate standpoint, from an ethical standpoint, from a medical science standpoint, and come with a solution to the problem in a smart way, which is good for, you know, for most of the people, if not all of the people who are involved. And I think we have to really think it through. We cannot have a knee-jerk extreme reaction one way or the other. There are some people who, you know, support late-term abortions, which is abhorrent, you know, just willy-nilly. I mean, that should not be done. I don't believe it is done that often, and it should never be done unless and until, you know, there's no other option. And like I said, no other option other than saving the life of the mother. And like I said, even in those situations, the doctors don't just abort the baby. They deliver the baby and try to make the baby survive to the best of their capability. So I think we have to look at, if we look at it from a medical science perspective, then I think we'll all be fine.
So just to put a bow on it, you don't believe the government should be involved in banning or allowing these procedures, whether it's masks, vaccines, abortion, and now newly add to the picture, IVF. You think it should just be left up to the medical professionals? There shouldn't really be any government regulations or laws saying either way around that?
For somebody who's doing unethical practices, illegal practices, you know, causing abortions and, causing the death of the mother or the fetus without any rhyme or reason. And there are guidelines, by the way, by the American College of OBGYN for abortions. And it rarely happens, like I said, after about 22 weeks or so, less than 1%, according to the American College of OBGYN numbers themselves. Governments, politicians, lawyers, judges, non-medical organizations, neither do they have the knowledge the experience or the wherewithal to actually interfere in medical care for the benefit of the patient more than the patient or the physician would decide as a team. And the purpose of the physician is to give the options to the patient. What options do they have? And have an informed consent, which is what we do on a regular basis, and let the patient decide what is best for them. We are not in a communist country where, you know, the government should be telling people whether you take a blood pressure medicine or you take this blood pressure medicine or that blood pressure medicine, or you have this kind of surgery or that kind of surgery. That should be left to the experts. That should be left to the doctor and the conversation with the patient. After a patient, if a patient gets diabetes, a patient gets high blood pressure, a patient gets pregnant, you know, any other than their family members, the only people who they have a one-on-one, you know, trustful conversation is their doctor. They don't go and talk to, you know, any Tom, Dick, and Harry in any organization or a politician or the local congressman or the senator for that matter. They talk to their doctor because they trust their doctor. And the doctor does the best to their ability. Doctors do the best to their ability to benefit the patients. That is what they do day in and day out. So I think that healthcare delivery system is a mess, which because doctors don't run the healthcare delivery system. The insurance companies, you know, all the high drug prices, the generic medications being made in China and not in the U.S., all that is not the doctors doing. The high prices of a CAT scan that you do in a hospital versus a radiology center, the high prices, the insurance costs, the deductibles, we don't do that. We just take care of patients. And so I think there needs to be more doctors in the house who can actually fix these problems and make people realize in Congress and the judiciary that for the most part, they do not know what they're talking about. And they are actually doing harm to the people who they are supposed to serve by just making wrong policies, which is to the detriment of patient care for health care and day-to-day lives. I mean, what a mess we are in right now with our economy, with our border, with healthcare. It's not because it's not the people's fault. It is because of all the wrong-headed policies that are being pushed by paper pushers like Herb Conaway and other people in Congress to the detriment of people. And we need to fix that. You need a person like me to fix that.
Definitely a lot of important issues to tackle there that will be debated on the campaign trail in the coming months. We'll wait and see what happens with your campaign. New Jersey 3rd District Republican Congressional candidate, Dr. Rajesh Mohan, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the time and the opportunity.
Well, that about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X at @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, if you just found the show for the very first time, like, oh my God, I love the show. It's so great, but where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You need to go to that browser of yours. You have to type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You put that in. You go right to the Fox Sports New Jersey podcast page. Then you scroll down till you find in the middle Joey Block. You're going to click on that. And all the podcast episodes will be there. We have the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Well, thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.